Hello, everybody. Welcome to Legislative. Anthony's going to get going and tell you all about it in just a couple minutes. But I wanted to thank ACB Media. I'd like to thank Desi is going to be our host. And we have our monitor and streamer. One is Deb Cook Lewis, and the other one is Cecily Nipper. And we have a door prize. And I can't find my brilliance. I don't know who it is that won, but I know what it is. So how about if I come back toward the end of the meeting and do it? And I apologize, Anthony, but my piece of equipment sprouted legs and left me.
Hey, Katie, this is Rick. I'm sitting in for both Cecily and Deb this afternoon.
Oh, you're our streamer today?
Yes, sir.
Right.
Yes, ma'am, till 4 o'clock. Yes, ma'am. I'm sorry.
And Desi, you're here?
Yes, I am.
Wonderful. All right. Well, she's going to handle raised hands, and you guys are in good hands with Anthony, and we will see you later.
Well, thank you for the thank yous, Katie. That saves me a couple of seconds. And to everybody out there on ACB Media Stream 8, welcome, welcome, welcome. Everyone in the Zoom room, welcome, welcome, welcome. This is your Florida Council of the Blind Legislative Panel. And I am sitting up here with previous president of Florida Council and previous president of the American Council, Paul Edwards. Hello. I am sitting up here also with Representative Rita Harris from Orlando. And all the way at the right-hand side is my counterpart from the Florida NFB. And we are all going to be talking about advocacy and how bills become laws and effective advocacy strategies. The reason I asked Russ to sit up on the panel with me is because I believe that if there are imperatives like this year, we had two of them that were in common, we should be working together. And when I took the chair last year, when Debbie handed it to me, Russ immediately introduced himself, and we've been working together for the past year. So I thought it would be really great to have someone from NFB sit up here with us as well. The theme is a little bit different than what you saw in your programs. There were some communication issues in the background, and you know how things are planning a convention. So I changed to this format. We're going to hear a little bit from Representative Harris. At 2 p.m., Representative Anna Eskamani will be joining us via Zoom. And so we'll hear from both perspectives, from the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. But this panel is a nonpartisan panel. We're not really talking about the issues themselves today, but how to advocate most effectively. And the reason I pivoted the panel this way is because the second half of the year, I wanted to focus on local relationships. We do an amazing job on the national level of getting our imperatives out there and establishing relationships with our representatives on the national level. But I think we've fallen back quite a bit here in Florida. And I think a lot of states are realizing that they have the same thing, and we're not maintaining those relationships. And of course, you know, the representative cycle is every 2 years. So, you know, we're learning and meeting new national representatives all the time and partially falling back on our efforts at keeping our local relationships established. So without further ado, I would like to introduce to you Representative Rita Harris.
Thank you so much, Anthony. And I hope it's okay. I am also a Democrat. So you have two Democrats on the panel, and I hope that's okay. When you said that, I was like, oh no, I need to make sure I clear that up real fast. Yeah, I am also a Democrat, but that's okay. That's okay. I can role play if you'd like as the other side, if you want me to. So my name is Representative Rita Harris. I serve House District 44, which is in South Orange County. If anybody's familiar with Gatorland, I live right behind there. And that's usually the marker that most people are familiar with when they think about where I live. I am a freshman in the Florida legislature. I was elected in August. And I got my start in advocacy actually as a teenager. I was a volunteer for Planned Parenthood. And actually what we did is we wrote scripts as teenagers about the different things that teenagers in that time were dealing with, things like drunk driving and even relationship violence. And then schools would be able to pick from a menu and we would go to these schools with perform. And side by side with creating these scripts and doing these performances, we were also trained on how to be peer counselors. So we got a lot of training on how to talk to kids our age and how to direct them to help if they needed it. And so I really kind of credit that experience in high school with helping me be a really good advocate and for having a lifetime of advocacy. As I got older, I had a daughter and she was dealing in high school with a mental illness. And so I became a strong advocate also for the rights of people with mental illnesses and making sure that we destigmatize all sorts of disabilities that people deal with, whether you can see them or whether you cannot see them. So I am really especially grateful to be here and at this amazing, momentous occasion, 70th anniversary of this incredible conference. And I really appreciate the invite and I'm happy to help in any way that I can.
So I'll go too far. All right. So thank you for giving us the brief synopsis. Can you give us a couple of examples of advocacy that you have been involved in that you felt was very effective? And in the examples that you give us, can you tell us sort of step by step how you gradiated to how you gradiated and outlined how you were going to present your advocacy?
Thank you. That is a good question. I find first and foremost that authenticity really helps. Each of you has a story, and your personal story is going to be most powerful when you're advocating. So advocating for your community, first and foremost, is so powerful, and being able to tell your story in an authentic way. And I think that is one of the best tools that we can use when we're advocating. And also, I feel that finding a place to relate to people, I feel like we really do, even in times like this where everything feels so very divided, there really are ways that we relate to each other more than we have differences. And I think forming those human connections helps maybe someone who might not necessarily see your point of view right away, it helps them to understand where you're coming from when you can kind of make that human connection right away.
So next, I was hoping you could tell us what the structure of the state office is, what your office looks like, how people make appointments, and what you look for when someone is contacting you with an advocacy issue.
That's a really good question. So each state house representative, if they have one, if I'm only in one county, so I only serve Orange County, so I have one state house office, and I have two different staff. I have a district staff, and that's usually where you would reach out to for a constituent issue. If you're living in the district and you're having a problem, you can email or call. And then we have a legislative staff, and they help us with policy. And so if you're looking to implement policy, if you have a bill idea or you're lobbying that you would like support for a bill, the legislative staff is who you would reach out for an appointment there. If you serve two different counties, and we have a lot of local representatives who serve, for instance, Osceola and Orange, or Seminole and Orange, you get two district offices, one in each county, and you get an extra staff member, an extra district staff. Oh, someone raised their hand and had a question. Do you want me to take that?
Hold on a second. Let me bring a mic here. Hold on. I want to hear the big mouth. You said if we had an issue, advocacy issue, and we need some help with some lobbying. How do we get in touch with the lobbyists?
So there is a lobby core, and there is a website called lobbytools.com, and I believe lobbyists are listed on that website. And so they are contact information. You could find out who lobbies. Different organizations have lobbyists that deal with different issues, whether it be constituent-based issues, or it be business-based issues.
And if we get in contact with them, they can pretty much say, hey, we'll help you, or go.
If there's if they have an interest in it. But I also want to reiterate that you have the ability to lobby for yourself as well. And so if there's an issue that you particularly feel very strongly about, I recommend reaching out to your local representative. In most cases, it's their first and last name at, like, for the state house, myfloridahouse.gov. So my email is rita.harris@myfloridahouse.gov. And if anybody has a constituent issue or a policy question, they can reach me there and we can set up a time to talk.
Would the policy issue, what if it's more than countywide? It's a statewide thing or even a United States-wide thing?
So I have a lot of constituents reach out to me and I'm not necessarily able to help them because it isn't in my purview, but I can certainly get constituents in touch with their congressperson or their county commissioner and help them make those connections that they might need.
Well, my concern is an easy one, and everybody's on this EV, electric car, yada, 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 but they don't make no noise when you're going down the highway or when you're trying to cross the street. You can't hear the suckers. So something needs to be done about that.
And that's really important to sense. And that's why it's like advocating self-advocacy or advocating for a community that you're really close to is important, because that might not be a point that other people would consider. And you bringing that up and talking about it, it would help people who create electric vehicles or people who are pushing for that policy to make sure that there's some way to create a noise that these cars would make so that people could still buy an electric vehicle, but they would be safer for people who are blind so that they are in a position where they can hear a vehicle coming and instead of one that's silent. So that's a really good point. And going to a state house representative or someone with that is a really good way that policy is formed.
Thank you so much. We will take some more questions at the tail end of the panel. All right, folks. So Representative Harris, one of the things we were going to talk about in the original iteration of this panel, for the first half of the year, we were focusing on paratransit issues. And myself and my partner, Mr. Edwards, previously, we all have been advocating in Miami for the paratransit system. It's for better. It has a lot of lack and spaces where it could be improved and matched to other systems around the country. One of the things we found was that we really needed to start establishing relationships with our board commissioners and such. And the media kind of helped out too. So as an advocacy strategy, where does the local representative fit in something like advocating for better paratransit?
That's a good question. So you stated, you kind of made the point that a lot of the transit issues are local with city council people or county commissioners. But as state representatives, you know, we're always able to, and we've done it in the past, write a letter of support and say, as a state representative, we support implementing policies like these on the county or on the city or municipal level. And, you know, we can also, as state people, we can also help direct the county and the city to funding, whether it be pulling it down from the federal or pulling it down from the state to help fund these initiatives if that is the issue. So it is it's good to reach out to a state house representative, even if it's a county issue, we can still lend our voice and lend support.
So now to the heart of the matter, what do you personally look for in advocacy? What strategies? You mentioned personal stories, of course, but what do you look for when someone is sitting down with you?
Thank you. Well, you know, I look for, you know, their honesty, their story. I want to hear their story. I love when people come prepared with information already to give to me. So some people will come in with numbers and stats that they've prepared. It makes it really easy for my team to kind of start digging in and figure out how we can solve that issue. So I think being well prepared, having information or documentation to bring when you have these meetings goes such a long way.
All right, in a moment, we're going to do some role playing. So if we could bring the other mic up. The last direct question that I'm going to ask you is, when an organization like ours wants to establish a relationship with your office, what are the primary means of contact?
Email or telephone are both great. You know, we get emails and we get telephone calls. And I think that you've done a great job at establishing a relationship with me. You reached out to me and you said, hey, I would love for you to come to this conference. And I would love to for you to meet, you know, some of our members. And that's a great way to establish a relationship. So, you know, when there's events in different places, reaching out to the local electeds and saying we're doing this event in this city or this county and we'd love to have you visit, you know, it opens up a door for relationships. So exactly what you already did. Now we have a relationship. Now I know you and you know me. And in the future, when you reach out to me, we're already going to have that now. That conversation is already starting. And I think that's just really effective.
All right. So again, don't go too far. Paul has graciously agreed to play our advocator who is coming in well prepared. After that, Russ, my counterpart from NFB, is going to play one that might not be as prepared. And Paul, myself, and the representative are going to jump in and we're going to talk about how to get it back on track and things like that. But if you, during that, hear something, you can feel free to do a quick no-no or uh-oh. So here you go.
Thank you very much, Representative, for sharing a little bit of your time with us. We really appreciate it. I've brought with me materials which I have already presented to you. And we've also talked with members of your staff, both at the local level and at the state level, in order to be sure that you understand the issue that we're bringing forward to you. I brought with me also a device. It's a magnification device, which you can see here. And the magnification device, as you can see, demonstrates how a blind person would be able to utilize that device and expand the size of the print that's there so that they would actually be able to see materials like mail when they get it at home. And if you notice in the bill number that we're asking you to support, what we're suggesting is that Medicare undertake a study that will look at the viability of utilizing a device like this one. This is a portable one, but sometimes people use bigger ones, a portable magnifier that will enable folks on Medicare to effectively operate at home, save a tremendous amount of money for taxpayers by not forcing these folks to move into independent living facilities and places like that, and instead be able to function effectively at home, handling mail and other activities that they need to handle and that this magnifier would allow them. As you know, Medicare has essentially said, if the device has a lens, we're not supporting it. We think that represents an inappropriate attitude, and we're hoping that you will support this bill, number 2542, which will enable us to demonstrate in just 5 years just how effective this device could be. Do you have any questions for me?
Wow, that was incredible. So yes, that is exactly what you want to do. That is such an effective way to advocate. You came in, you established that you've already met with some of my members. You know our group. We've had conversations before. You jogged my memory. You let me know the bill number, because believe it or not, there's a lot of bill numbers. And sometimes, you know, it can be hard sometimes to remember the bill number. You kind of know them by name more than bill. You established the bill number. You stated what the problem was. What is the problem and how is this bill going to solve it? And you ask for support. And I think that's the perfect way that you go into a meeting with a representative and try to get their support. And I would have said, absolutely, you have my support. That sounds like a great idea. And I will be happy to support that bill. Or if I had a space to run a bill, I'd be happy to run a bill like that for you. So I think that was just an incredible job.
All right, so if you can hand this mic to Russ, Paul, keep yours. Let's see the other side.
We've already started by holding the microphone upside down.
My bad.
I've got to be smarter than the microphone. So, Congressman, we have come to you in the past asking for support on numerous issues, and I find it strange that you've never supported us before. We've asked for support, and we haven't seen anything come out of your office to tell us that you care. So that's kind of confusing, because the Republicans love us. And they think this bill is awesome. I don't actually remember the bill number, but I think my colleague already gave it to you. But what I do remember is that it's about Medicare and how important Medicare and transportation are, I think. Excuse me, I've got to take a call. Hold on a second. This isn't... My mother.
I offered to take the other side.
All right, Paul, let's tag team.
Yes.
I don't remember the bill number. For me, I think that's the most glaring. But he started out his introduction in a negative manner.
It's always good to antagonize a representative early. And the moment you make it a partisan issue and point to the political party that she is a part of and suggest that in fact the other guy supported it, what you're essentially assuring is that she will at least be inclined to say, well, that's nice, hope you enjoy it.
All right, there's a hand. Is there another mic or just the two that we have here?
You can take mine.
Oh, yes, too.
All right.
Okay, so here's the thing. My name's Janine. Hi. So if you say I don't remember the bill number, maybe you just can't remember like the whole 10-digit number. Like that's a little tricky sometimes with the bill number. So your colleague, like if I went with Russ, he could say, I don't remember the bill number. And then if I'm with him, I could be, oh, Russ, that's 987-65432. So, I mean, why is it so bad that you can't remember the exact number? Because I don't think that's such a red flag.
Well, it's not a red flag. And if anybody came in and forgot a bill number, I would not hold it against them. I just think that when you're prepared and you have the bill number that you're advocating for, it's just, you're making the conversation a lot easier for everybody involved. So I recommend that you, like when you're advocating for a bill, that you do try to know the bill number. But if somebody didn't remember, I would never hold it against them. And we often do have people come in and lobby in a group. And there's often, you know, four or five or six people in my office at one time talking about something that's really, really important to them. And so, like you said, if you're someone that, you know, like, you know, I'm not going to remember that. Usually someone else will be in charge of like remembering all the little minor details. But I think that, you know, the feedback about it, you know, bringing it up and making it partisan right away doesn't help. And taking a phone call probably wouldn't be good. But if it was an emergency, again, someone had an emergency phone call during a meeting, and I get that. I'm a parent, but that was good. That was a really good example.
Anthony, I would just say one thing to that, to Janine, and that is, if from our perspective, not remembering the bill number is an issue because of the fact that we are not handling very many bills. We're not taking all that many to the group. And what Russ could have done and probably should have done, if he didn't remember the bill number, don't say, I don't remember the bill number. Instead say, this bill's about. Because that way you're not indicating that you don't know what you're talking about. What you're doing instead is moving ahead and shielding yourself from admitting to not being as prepared as you should be.
So Paul, what would be, in your opinion, what would be an effective way to let the representative know that some of her colleagues are supporting it, already supporting it, or thinking about supporting it? And is there an effective way to let them know that the colleagues from the other side of the aisle may or may not be looking?
Sure. I think one of the most important things to do, especially in legislatures like the kinds that we have now, that tend to be pretty firmly divided between the two parties in terms of attitudes that operate that out there, for us to say right up front, because it makes what we say all that more powerful, is we're happy to say that this bill already has sponsors from both political parties. Because then you're indicating to the legislature that this is already a bipartisan effort, and she doesn't have to think about having to decide whether she's going to buck the leadership of her party in order to support this bill, but instead can already operate on the assumption there's support from both sides of the aisle.
All right, so hands in Zoom and folks in the room, we'll take some questions. Representative Escamani is gonna join us at 2 p.m.
We have no hands at this time in Zoom.
Any questions now?
I just want to point out a couple things. First of all, most of the time when you go visit an office, especially for the first time, you're going to see a legislative assistant. And they have lots of issues, and people come to them, and their issues are the most important in the world. So it behooves us to be prepared. There is nothing wrong with having a kind of cheat sheet, whatever format works for you. If you need to have a little earphone in your ear, if you don't read Braille or large print, whatever it happens to be, because sometimes when you're in a meeting, you've got to get their attention fast because they're on their phones. They're doodling. Sometimes you're standing out in the hall meeting with them. So it's not cruel to say that you shouldn't have forgotten the number. What you do is you are prepared in case you do forget the number. And I know in ACB and FCB, we always prepare with longer cheat sheets that then you can take and pare down to work for your initiative. So just remember that we've got to be prepared because time is short, and whatever impression you're going to make, you got to make it immediately. Get their attention or their brains are off somewhere else.
Debbie, I just want to say that that's so important. I mean, even as an elected official, when I run for office, I drop off paper at people's houses, something so that they can remember me, because also, like you said, there's a lot coming at you. So having that paper helps us to have that on hand that we can always reflect back to it.
Good afternoon. This is DJ. To add an addendum to what the young lady said, when you're going into an office, the first, I would say, 10 seconds, you may have their attention. After that, it's almost a lost cause, really. But my question or comment has to do with, okay, so you're going into a person's office, a legislator's office, maybe their assistant, but if you do happen to meet that person and you give your spiel, you give your pitch, what you're advocating for, and yet you use the opposite party as, for example, what was gave, and say, well, we support this bill, the Republicans love it. My question is, do you feel in the best interest of quote-unquote advocacy or lobbying? Is that the best approach, or is that a good approach to use by, utilizing opposite party name?
Thank you. I don't. And I really like how it was framed as bipartisan, because I think as legislators, and we are especially cognizant of the fact that it feels very, it is very divided out there, that when we're able to see policy that both sides support, it is both good for us, and it's also good for the people of our state, Florida, to see that while we're divided in many aspects, there are a lot of ways that we come together. So whenever an advocate comes to my office and says, you know, this has bipartisan support, you know, that's good. It means that, you know, we are working together to get something done. And it means it's also going to have a better chance of crossing the finish line and getting passed, which is ultimately what we want, is to get it passed and signed into law. So I think pointing that out is very, very effective when trying to gain the support of somebody from either party, rather than saying, well, the other side supports it, why don't you, saying we have a lot of bipartisan support. It's like, okay, that's great. I love that. And there's another question in your, it's coming around. Oh, there's two. Yeah.
Hi. So I have another question. So I know when you go to your office and you meet with people, sometimes you meet with the LA, which is the legal assistant, right? And then there's times we meet with you. Now, is it important that we, like, if we're bringing a gift, like, I was lucky enough to be with people in Washington, and I had masks made for them with the United States and the flag on them. So is it important to give one to the LA and then leave one for you too? And are gifts important so you remember us, or should we not give you gifts? Because yeah, that's my question. Because you know, when you go to a job interview, you write a thank you note and you like send a gift card or a chocolate bar or something so you stand out. So do the gifts, A, make you stand out? And then B, do you need to give both gifts to the LA and to you, who's the higher up?
I steer clear of gifts because there's a lot of legality around gift giving and lobbying as well. So I'm just happy to have you there. I'm happy to hear from you. I hear from people on, you know, all sides of the political spectrum and people with a lot of all different issues. And I just enjoy the fact that, I mean, Tallahassee is far away. Very few people live actually near Tallahassee, right? The state is very large and very long in how it's built and how it is. And so the fact that a lot of people come hours and hours away, they either fly here or they come by car, that alone is just very effective to me. Like, you came all the way up there to talk, to look me in the face and tell me what your issue is. You have my attention. You don't need to give me a gift. And I appreciate that.
Hi, Sherry Mullenbrath. I've been to Tallahassee a few times, and you know, everybody's got their own personality. And there are some of the representatives, senators, whatever, that are just so happy to see us, and they remember your name from last year, and they want to get their picture with you. And everybody loves to go to that person. And then there are some that they're busy, so we have to see the assistant. And you'll hear, you know, the chatter among, you know, the group that's going up there, well, they don't even care to see us and blah, blah, blah. But I'm kind of, and I want to know if this is true, I'm kind of in the thought that, well, that person is your assistant, your right hand man or woman, whatever, and if you can convince that person, you know, that what you're doing and what you're wanting is a really good thing. Is it true that it's some of them say it's even better to get the assistant on board, or you know, what do you think about that kind of what would be the right attitude about that? Whether we see the actual representative or the assistant, is it this one and the same?
That is such a great question. First and foremost, you know, I always think it's really important to build a good relationship with a legislative assistant. When I was an advocate, I was always made sure that I was always, you know, super polite, super kind, even when dealing with a representative who was opposite of the position that I was dealing with. Of course, I'm going to always lean in on the idea that it's much more impactful to meet with the actual representative if you can, but sometimes schedules, even representatives that are really friendly to your issue, sometimes schedules just don't work out and you have to meet with the legislative aide. So yeah, I think it's great to build that relationship with the legislative staff so that they know your name, you know their name. You know, we are very close to our legislative staff. You know, we go through 60 days with them right by our side. And so they really do have a huge influence on us. And getting your message to them, if you can't reach the representative, is still very powerful. And you should still take that time to talk to them too.
So I want to check in Zoom and see if we have any hands there.
Currently, there are no hands in Zoom.
Thank you so much.
Shannon.
All right, we'll take one more question in the room.
Shannon, this is more of a statement or experience. I was a salesman for a long time, and when you're going up to advocate for an issue, you're actually selling something. So being that said, the first thing you should do is go and meet the person, shake hands, make eye contact. And since we're in the South, I want you to stay away from, you know, so-and-so, how are you doing? Do not say that. Say, good to see you. Because sometimes that how you doing gets into a 10-minute conversation. Then it plays over, you know? I mean, we're in the South, and we're used to that. That's what we talk. But try to stay away from that. And the biggest thing is she was saying earlier about the number of the bill. Yes, you should know that. But you also should specify the features and the benefits of exactly what you're talking about. So stay on track, and then hopefully you can keep them from glassing over. When you do that, ask them a question, and that'll keep them back on track. And then I guess I do have a question, is once we do see the staff, how do we know that doesn't just get kicked down the road and the staff member doesn't care for
Yeah, I would definitely follow up. And, you know, a staff member that would just kick something down the road would probably be a staff member. I know me personally as a representative, that would be a concern for me if my staff member did that, because every person they meet with, if I can't meet with them, it's just important that I have their information, I'm able to reach out. But I would definitely follow up, you know, email the representative and say, I had a chance to talk to your legislative aide. We had a great conversation about ... Were you able to hear about that? Do you have any questions? Did you want to reach out to me directly? That's a really good way to ensure that the, you know, there was a connection made and that we got the information from our LA.
So we're going to pivot a little bit. Representative Escamani is going to talk to us a little bit about how an issue becomes a bill, becomes a law in Florida. But I want to also talk about public comment and the actual legislative cycle. Can you tell us a little bit about the cycle here in Florida and how we can get our personal and organizational comments known during the cycle?
Okay, thank you. So we have alternate years. Our legislative session starts at different times, and it's mostly because of how our election cycles work. So we're coming up to a legislative session where we'll be starting in January and ending in March. And our committee weeks start in September. So committee is where you start to hear bills. And all during committee, when bills are on committee and you're interested in it, and either you want to advocate for or you want to advocate in opposition of it, you can go up to Tallahassee, you can fill out a speaker card, and you can stand before the committee and, you know, plead why you are for this bill, why they should vote up on it, or why they should vote down on it, and maybe end the bill right there. So those are some really good ways. So like I said, this session, the committee weeks will start in September. Usually we do like one, and then we have like 3 weeks off, and then we do another week, and we have 2 weeks off, and then it kind of gets more frequent until we come right into session. We also have committee weeks in the beginning of session as well. So just because session starts in January doesn't mean that your opportunity to go up and advocate for your issue is over. There are still committee weeks ongoing until we start really getting into session, and then we're on the floor most of the time.
Do you think there is a perfect time as between
during the session and the committee section of this of the cycle for people to come to Tallahassee?
I think anytime. Obviously, though, if you're trying to stop a bill from becoming law, you want to get in on those early committees to see if you can end a bill right there in the committee before it gets further. But if you're advocating for a bill, anytime you're able to get up there and advocate is, you know, very powerful. If you're not able to get up there, and, you know, there are a lot of people that are not able to get up there for a lot of various reasons, you can also call. And you can also write an email. And believe it or not, legislative staff, they do track how many pros and how many cons come in for a bill. So that's another way that you could advocate if you're not able to go up to Tallahassee and speak before a committee.
Thank you.
How often do you see the emails that come in on specific issues? Do you get like a written report on how many yay, how many nays, and some of the comments, or do you read most of the emails that come into you, your office?
So emails come in two ways. Emails either come in directly to my email address. I see all of those, and we have what they call rules, and rules will kind of take an email and kind of usher it into a folder, and that way we can like read them and count how many are for or how many are against an issue. And then emails also come in from the Find Your Representative website, and on there it will show your representative, it'll show your district, and also have a button that says write your representative. That goes into a program called IndyGov, and that is where our district or our legislative staff will see those. And a lot of those are constituent issues, so it's good that they go there because those are the issues that the district staff would be dealing with. But issues that come into my email box, I read them all. Sometimes they're form letters, so it's 50 of the same email. It says the same thing, but you know, I do look, you know, in that case, I look them over and we make a note. We make an actual hashtag, a scratch mark of how many people are for or against an issue.
Also, in the same vein, when an email is coming in, can you give us a few tips on how to effectively get your attention? I personally believe that short and sweet emails, hey, this is who I am, this is where I'm from, this is the issue, and these are the reasons. Thank you so much.
Yes, exactly. Especially when they're form letters, I think short and sweet is really good. Much like how, the good advocacy in person tip, this is the bill number, this is what it does, and this is who it's going to help. If it has bipartisan support, mention that too. And I would really love your support. Please vote up on this bill. And vice versa, if it's a bad bill and it's going to hurt people, please don't support this bill. You know, this is the bill number, this is who it's going to impact. We ask that you not support this bill. Please vote down. I think those are the most impactful. No, it's okay. So most committees are separated by House and Senate. So you would, depending on what committee you want to stand before, you could sign up. The committee weeks happen concurrently on both sides. So you could, I've gone to a committee on the House side and then later on went and spoke at a committee on the Senate side. There are a few joint committees, though they rarely ever meet. And that's where the House and the Senate are in one committee together. But most of the time you're going to either be addressing a committee on the House or a committee on the Senate, just depending on where the bill is. That's okay. That's a good question. They bounce back and forth, yeah. So it just depends on where it is at the time. But I encourage advocating on both sides, because there is something, for instance, if you're trying to, end a bill, if you feel like a bill is going to be really hurtful to your community, the Senate has a different makeup and you might be able to get something to end there more easily. You might be able to get more traction there than you would on the House side.
For issues that are statewide issues that do not have any bills or even anything in the committee, what is the best way to come to a representative to get them to consider bringing it into a committee for bill?
That is such, and I know I say this a lot, but that's such a good question. So Every session, we have the ability to file 7 bills. Each representative can file 7 bills of their own. And that deadline for this next session coming up would be July 1st. So you want to make sure that you're going to talk to people, you know, and I think the deadline for the end of it is probably in the beginning of January. I don't have the date offhand, but it's going to be right as session starts. That's when the filing deadline ends. So you're going to want to make sure that you get a representative to run your bill in that time frame, or else if it's too late to file, they have to wait until the next session to file that bill. You know, I would look, if you are able to research and see which representatives might be friendly to your cause. They might have run similar bills or bills that have impacted communities that are adjacent or communities that you feel kind of line up with yours. And you write them or you try to visit them in Tallahassee and you say, this is an idea I have for a policy, and I would like to know if you would run this bill. Sometimes, as a legislator, if all of my 7 slots are filled, I can't, but sometimes I'll file a bill so that it's filed, because remember, we have that filing deadline and we want to make sure the bill is filed. So sometimes I'll file a bill for a group while we look for a legislator that can run it. So, you know, even if you haven't found a legislator yet that can run your bill, if you have a good relationship with the legislator and they're willing to at least file it so it's safe, have them do that while you look to find someone that can run it, and then we can transfer it to that legislator. And we're always looking for bills that are going to help people. I mean, at the end of the day, most of us, regardless of the side that we're on, want to help people. That's why we're here. That's why we're doing this. So, you know, if you have a bill that's really going to help people, take it to a legislator and say, could you run this? And if they can't, you know, let's find someone who can.
Could you talk a little bit about the process of co-sponsoring bills and how you all circulate amongst yourselves some of the issues that are happening in the state?
Yeah, so any bill that is filed and is, you know, any bill that's filed, you can co-sponsor it. So, and often there are a lot of bipartisan bills that are out there that have sponsorship from both sides. And that's just a way that we can show support. And especially early on in the life of a bill, it helps, you know, if, you know, I am a Democrat, so I am in a minority party in a super majority House. But if I have a bill that has bipartisan support and I can get some of my Republican colleagues to sign on and co-sponsor that bill, that signals to committees that are, you know, ahead of this bill that maybe they should agenda this. Maybe this is something that will pass and people can support on both sides. So it's really important to kind of find, if you have a bill, that you can kind of find a co-sponsorship that's bipartisan. And it's a really good way, if it's not my bill, like there's lots of bills that I love and I think they're great bills, but I can't file it. Someone else already filed it. But it's my way of saying, I support this idea. I think this is a great bill. I'm going to put my name on it and help it pass.
If you had to sort of break it down into a percentage wise, how much more effective is it for cross coalitions? Like, as I mentioned at the beginning of this, you know, there's the American Council of the Blind and the National Federation of the Blind. There are other cross disability modalities, et cetera, et cetera. How much more attention do you pay to issues that are coming with cross group support?
So for me personally, I pay attention to a lot of the issues. So even if you came by yourself, I would listen. But I think that it helps build momentum. And I think it definitely helps to share resources for the group itself. And I've been a part of like one single group that has built a coalition, and you just have, you know, there's strength in numbers. You have more people that can do the work, and that's always very helpful. You're able to advocate more. You can send more people up there to lobby, and that's going to help as well. So definitely if you have partners and you all share the same type of, you know, advocacy lane, I think it's really important to form these relationships and build a team. Earlier I said teamwork makes the dream work, and it really does. It helps a lot.
So I would like to give Russell the opportunity to ask any questions that he has before we transition to Representative Escamani, and we'll do one more check for the room and Zoom after Russ.
All right, so thinking about a lot of different things as I was listening to those great comments. So Anthony and Paul both were just knocking it out of the park. And the questions from the audience were helping me too think of a few things. And one of the things that crossed my mind, I'm going to skip over the thought I had about the relationships with legislative aides. I will say that I think, real quickly, if I might, Anthony, that building a relationship with the staff of an elected official is critical. It's really critical. There's a lot of different reasons. And there's a person in the office that you reach out to schedule an appointment, whether it's a federal or state appointment, a U.S. House or a Florida House, for example. They have a scheduler. If you don't think that person has some power, think again. They can effectively keep you away from that elected official. Whether they mean to or not, whether it might be how you approach them, it might be your technique, it might be for different reasons, but they have a lot more power than you realize, as do legislative aides, legislative assistants, chief of staffs. They all speak to one another, and often they will talk to one another after you meet with them and decide whether an issue you brought to them, let's say you meet with a legislative aide, they'll actually make the decision on whether it even gets into the rep's field of view. I don't know if everybody knows that. So building that relationship is really important. I called the other day my U.S. House member in Jacksonville, Representative John Rutherford, out of District 5, U.S. House District 5, and I've gotten to know his legislative director a little bit through meeting with him over the years. I called the office, the phone rang, and I said, greetings, this is Russ Davis, I'm with the National Federation of the Blind of Florida. And the man said, oh, hey, Russ, it's Kevin, how are you? And of course, my ego went through the roof because, you know, I thought maybe I was important. But what it told me was that I had built a relationship with this individual. And I didn't have to hem and haw about anything. I didn't even have to, you know, make nice. You have to be nice, but I was able to just say, so, Kevin, here's what I need. Because that's the man I actually was trying to reach. Perfect. Doesn't happen too often, but that relationship is critical. The other thing I just really wanted to ask you about was when we get ready to meet with an elected official, and you've done plenty of that even before you were elected, how much good does it do us to do a little background research and find out about that individual? Maybe find out what makes them tick a little bit, what their background is. Do they have a family? Do they have issues that maybe there's something in common, you know? And how much of that is important in establishing a relationship with the rep when you finally meet with them?
I think it goes a long way. You know, it shows, I think that you sort of hit the nail on the head when you talked about relationships with the LA, with the legislative aides and the chief of staff. A lot of politics and a lot of advocacy both are about relationships, about building relationships with your colleagues, building relationships with communities, building relationships with legislators. And so when you take the time before you come and visit a legislator to find out especially what they're interested in, like what policies they like, it helps. Yeah, what committees they're on is super important because you want to make sure they're on a committee that can even help you in the first, like if you're trying to get a bill passed, you want someone on that committee that's going to vote up on it, right? But yeah, so knowing what committee is really important. But I think it goes a long way because again, it goes back to that committed, that relationship. And then vice versa, I always recommend, you know, I'm a first-time legislator. This is my first time in the House. But I also try to find out a little bit about the groups that I'm meeting with. You know, I want to see what makes them tick as well. I want to make sure that before I meet somebody, I know what their issues are. So I'm prepared for what their ask might be or for what they're looking for from me in support of or to oppose. So I think it's a two-way street. It's a relationship. And I think that goes a long way.
So let's check in with Zoom real quick. Do we have any hands?
Yes, we have. Sheila has her hand raised.
Sheila's our president.
I know. You can go ahead.
Thank you, Desi. Thank you, Representative Harris. Not sure if you know, but I'm in the hospital. So unfortunately, I am not there in person. So I am so sorry I'm not able to meet you. I live in Orange County. Anyway, I would love to here because I'm hearing this conversation, and I know our ACB advocacy and governmental affairs director is in the audience, and I would love to hear his take on some of this because he does this every day for ACB. So if it would be okay, I would like a microphone taken to Clark, and I would like to hear what his input is on some of this because he is very instrumental in our legislative works.
Thank you, sir. And thank you, Sheila. Thanks to Sheila and the folks in this room. This is my first time at the FCB convention. So, long-time supporter, first-time attendee. I think Anthony and Paul and others have done a great job with this conversation. And why is that? Because they're seasoned pros when it comes to advocacy. And I think I also heard Debbie Grubb in the room, another long-time advocate for ACB and the Floridians. I could not agree more with the building relationship, not only with your representative, your senator, your delegate, you know, the elected official, but today's interns are tomorrow's schedulers, our next year's legislative aides, and in some days they might be the member of whose support you're seeking to gain. So building those relationships throughout all levels of the office of staff can only help your cause. And I do agree with Paul and Anthony. It's important to know your issue. It shows that you are dedicated. It shows that you are passionate. And it helps convey the importance of the issue to the representative. That doesn't mean we all don't make mistakes, right? You forget a bill number, you forget a bill number. Don't dwell on it. But you know why you're there, bill number or not. It's because the specific issue is important to you. And I think it's kind of funny how we talk about, you know, bipartisan support. Well, as Anthony said earlier, we have both sides, meaning ACB and NFB, you know, supporting two legislative imperatives on the national level. And I'll just ask a quick question in the room here. If folks know what Representative Rutherford, Representative Castor, and I'm probably going to get this name wrong, but Representative Sheila Scherfelis McCormick from Florida's 20th district, what those three have in common? Well, I will share that they are all co-sponsors of H.R. 1328 in the United States House of Representatives, and that is the Medical Device Non-Visual Accessibility Act. Yes, so that bill has 44 Democratic co-sponsors and 4 Republican co-sponsors. Again, that's H.R. 1328, a shared legislative imperative of ACB and NFB. And as Anthony was just saying, great job to the folks in this room and the folks listening for conveying the importance of that legislation through your relationships, through your phone calls, your emails, and your visits. We still have plenty of work to do to get this bill passed into law, but that is a great start.
Congratulations, that's amazing.
So, Representative Harris, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom with us and for spending time with us. You're going to stick around after the program and shake some hands?
Yes.
All right. So before...
Are we done with Sheila?
So before I turn this over to our next speaker, who is joining us via Zoom because she has a lot of important meetings, I happened to catch her on MSNBC last night, and a very succinct and incredible conversation with Alex Wagner. But I digress, as I'm known to do. My charge as your current governmental affairs chair, and my charge to all of you out there listening on ACB Media as well, is to establish your relationships with your local offices. to establish relationships with your national offices, and most importantly, to establish relationships with your governmental affairs committee. Earlier in the year, I put a big push to have each local chapter kind of designate someone to come to our meetings, to bring issues to us so that we can, you know, we're only human. We can only work on what we catch, what we see. And because we're only human, we can only do a few things at a time. So I'm truly, truly urging you today with this program to go back to your local chapters and to establish how do you want to interact with your advocacy? How do you want your Florida Council of the Blind and our great parental organization, American Council of the Blind, to advocate for you? But I also charge you right back. How are you going to show your organization, your local chapter, your FCB, and your national, what have you done? Have you sent the email? Have you called the office? Have you established the relationship as well? That's my charge, and that's what I hope for the second half of the year the committee will really be strongly working on, and then you guys do your part, and you come to us as well. We can extend the invitation, but if you guys don't take it, then there's not much more we can do. A lot of times we're very loud in how we think things should be done, but I think we're falling off slightly on how much we're actually doing to get that message out there effectively. So without any more of me going on and on, I would like to introduce via Zoom Representative Anna Escamani, who's going to tell us a little about herself, her journey to her seat now, and she's going to tell us a little bit about how issues become bills, become legislation here in Florida. Welcome, 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 Anna.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Anthony. Thanks for your amazing leadership, and thank you to everyone for the invitation and for allowing me to join via Zoom as I am traveling for different meetings this weekend. So I do appreciate the opportunity to share space and be with you virtually. And again, my name is Anna V. Escamani. For those in the space, I am a 33-year-old elected official. I'm a person of color. Right now I'm wearing shades of gray. So I have a gray tank on with a gray sweater on top. And I do have with me too, I always wear my rainbow ribbons as a sign of solidarity with the LGBTQ plus community, as it's also Pride Month as well. Thank you. Thank you.
You're getting applause in the room.
I can see. Thank you for that. I appreciate y'all. And so with that said, really just grateful to be in the space and to help kind of unpack this, right? To talk about the legislative process and how to be a part of it. And I first just want to start, you know, with a little bit about my background, because I come from an apolitical environment. So I grew up as the daughter of working class immigrants. My parents actually came from Iran, but met each other working at the same donut shop in Orlando. So a true American love story. We did everything we could to achieve the American dream in Florida. In particular, my parents sacrificed so much for their kids to have a better opportunity than they ever would. I have a twin sister named Ida and a big brother named Aria. And we went to public schools. You know, we did everything we could to get good grades and to fit in. And my family went through a serious challenge and loss when my mom was diagnosed with cancer. And I was about 9-10 years old when she first was diagnosed. And unfortunately, after about 4 years of fighting, she passed away when I was 13 years old. And so a lot of what I do every single day is grounded in honoring those no longer with us through action. And of course, uplifting the memory and legacy of my mom, who is one of the most selfless people that anyone could meet. And so with that said, when I got to high school, I actually was really involved in high school theater. So I'm a theater nerd, a Broadway nerd, love musicals, all that kind of stuff. And I was not a performer. I was a techie. So my sister and I did props, costumes, set pieces. But that was such a great foundation for me in high school to have an appreciation for arts and culture. And of course, appreciation for diverse communities and ways to connect with diverse communities. that when I got to UCF as an undergrad, I eventually decided to double major in political science, international relations focus, and women and gender studies. And I really dived into issues that impact women and girls. And I remember my first ever trip to the state capitol was actually when I was about 20 years old. And at UCF, there's something called a day at the Capitol, where as students, we go up to Tallahassee to advocate for, you know, issues that affect our schools. And we would actually kind of do our own script. We would come up with UCF, but then myself and a few other students with the College Democrats, we did our own programming and focused on issues like voter suppression, disability rights, bright futures. And we really kind of drew our own, you know, policy agenda, if you will. And of course, that involvement led me to continue down the path of community advocacy, eventually working at Planned Parenthood of Southwest and Central Florida, and then running for office as a first-time candidate back in 2018. So I'm actually approaching my last 2 years in the Florida House. I'm going to hit my term limit soon. And of course, it's been a really challenging, but also impactful 5 years of service so far. So let's dive into just the legislative process at a state level. And then we do want to open up for questions and hear some of your thoughts, insights, and ideas. So first of all, it's so important for us to focus on state politics. You know, we talk so much about DC, the White House. I mean, obviously, you know, we just avoided a collapse of the United States government with the debt ceiling talks. So most of the national media, as you mentioned too, Anthony, you know, focuses on what's happening at the congressional and federal level. And that is important. And of course, you know, as a state representative, we kind of serve as the intermediate between the local municipal officials and the federal officials. So we do keep in touch with all levels of government as those in the middle. But of course, state government affects every part of your life. I mean, so many of our social services are managed at a state level. Everything from transportation issues to public education to our libraries to our environmental protection policies. Of course, when it comes to issues impacting the correctional system, all of that ties into state government. And our one constitutional responsibility as state elected officials is to craft a balanced budget, which means we allocate dollars that are collected from you, the taxpayer, to different government needs and areas of service. And I should note that about 37% of Florida's state budget is funded by the federal government. So we don't balance our budget without the help of the Fed, but it's our job as lawmakers to dictate where those dollars go. So that brings me to the actual process of how a bill becomes a law, and also the process of the state budget, because there are many systems, especially the Agency for Persons with Disabilities waitlist, as y'all know, that is severely underfunded and has about 22,000 people still waiting for services. And all that ties back to the legislative session. So in the legislature, you have 120 state house representatives and 40 state senators. Every state is different, right? And the other part about Florida is our districts are huge. So despite being a part-time legislature, our districts as state house members typically have about 170,000 people. If you ever look at the stats for states like Maine, Montana, you know, these are legislatures that their districts have upwards of maybe 10 to 20,000 people. So we have huge districts and not enough staff. We only have two staff members to help manage a district that size. The state senators, they have usually three staffers and their districts are about twice the size of ours. So again, very large districts, not enough staff. And of course, the fact that we're part-time legislatures mean that we're paid part-time. So my salary as a state house representative is about $28,000. I have another full-time job. That's my main source of income, as most lawmakers do, or most lawmakers are very wealthy. They come from a place of wealth. Maybe it's family money. Maybe it's their retirement. But, you know, it does create a barrier for everyday people to run for office, because not only is running for office expensive, but once you get into office, it can be difficult to even maintain an income, because, again, you're working full time, but you're not paid full time. So with that said, you have an awesome idea that you want to see it be placed into law, or maybe you have a nonprofit organization that you want to get funding for, state funding for. So where do you start? The first place is with your elected official. And like Anthony mentioned, knowing who represents you in the legislature is critical. And you can find this out by going to myfloridahouse.gov. And again, that's myfloridahouse.gov. All spelled out, .gov. And when you get to that website, you can click on the Find Your Representative tab and just put in your address, and it will break it down. Who's your state representative? Who's your state senator? And just for the context, also, who's your member of Congress? But getting to know who those two individuals are, the state level that represents you, is really critical, because they're the first people you should go to when you have some sort of policy or funding idea. And when you have that meeting, you know, obviously you want to bring with you any type of experiences, anecdotes, data, evidence. You want information to help support what your need is, what your claims are, what the project you want funded is, because all of that helps in building your case of why this should be filed and considered as either legislation or a funding request. Now, speaking of funding requests, lawmakers, we actually don't have a cap on how many funding requests we can make. So we can file as many funding requests as we like to. Obviously, it can be difficult to get everything in the budget that we file, but we don't have a cap on how many of those projects we can file. On the bill side, it's a little bit different. As a state house representative, we only have 7 bill slots. So that means every year I can only file 7 new bills. So I will tell you, especially with a district our size, it can become very challenging, because every year we have more bill ideas than we have slots. So the earlier you talk to a lawmaker about an idea you have, the better, because it helps get you a slot before they get full. And it also just gives you an opportunity to talk to more than one lawmaker. What we have often experienced at our office is, if we don't have room for someone, we'll at least put their idea into bill drafting, which allows us to find someone else to file it. And the more time we have to do that, the better. With that denoted, you know, once you're able to actually get your bill idea drafted and filed, then you approach the committee process. And this is going to sound very familiar, because it mimics the federal level of a bill becoming a law. If you've ever listened to Schoolhouse Rock, you know, similar motif of a bill gets assigned committees. It has to be shepherded through those committees to eventually come to the House and Senate floor. I will say that, you know, bills change a lot throughout the process. So you have to be really engaged throughout these steps, because you don't want an amendment to happen to your bill that you don't like. And it's very possible that a bill you didn't like at the beginning becomes one that you do like at the end, or opposite. So the committee process requires engagement. It requires conversations with the committee chair, vice chair, ranking member, all the other members. Obviously, your bill sponsor should be leading on this and helping with this by setting up those meetings and having those conversations. And if you have resources, some organizations also hire lobbyists. So they have someone working on their behalf to help pass this bill, watch the bill for you. But of course, not every organization has those types of resources. So oftentimes you're either doing it yourself or with a grassroots community of supporters, and or that lawmaker is your main ally. Now, this brings me to another good point about coalition building, because I think it is really important, especially in Tallahassee, to identify different allies. And there could be more traditional allies, like other groups that, you know, work on similar issues and you work together on this bill. But sometimes it's also kind of unexpected allies. Maybe it's the business community or the faith-based community. Maybe there's a specific university. You know, I'll give you a quick example. One of the bills that we were able to get passed this past session was a permanent tax break on children's diapers and adult incontinence products. And we teamed up with both the AARP, which is you know, one of our retirement advocacy organizations, alongside the Florida State University's Elder Law Clinic. And the Elder Law Clinic in particular helped a lot in building attention support on the tax break for adult incontinence products. If it wasn't for their advocacy, I honestly don't know if we would have been successful in including adult products in that tax break. But these FSU law students, they penned op-eds, they testified in committee, they did research on the topic, they were very engaged. And that was one of those kind of unexpected allies we had in the process. So assuming you're able to get your bill through its committees, and by the way, your bill could maybe have 2 committee assignments, 3 committee assignments. I've even seen 4 committee assignments. The number of committees often dictate what leadership thinks about your bill. So if leadership likes your bill, they'll give it less committee stops. If they have concerns and questions, they'll probably give it more. So it just kind of depends on where leadership sits on your issue, which again is important to talk to the speaker's office, have those conversations with the Senate president, and understand what, if any, concerns are there about your issue. And part of this is thinking about who would be against your bill and why, and trying to neutralize that opposition before it hits a point where it actually could stop your bill from passing or stop your bill from moving. Assuming you've done all of that, your bill has moved through the process, you get to the House floor, it passes. The work is not over, because once a bill passes, now you have to make sure that the governor signs it into law. And the governor could veto it, or the governor can sign it. And so continuing your dialogue and advocacy with the executive branch is the next step. And something you could do along the way to prepare for passage, but we definitely want to follow up with the governor's office afterwards to ensure that they understand the intention of the bill and they're not going to veto the bill. And then, of course, once it's signed into law, now it's about implementation. And I see so many advocacy organizations that once a bill passes and gets signed into law, they kind of walk away from it and say, okay, job well done. You know, we have nothing else to do on this. But the irony is that implementation is just as important as passage. And oftentimes there's a state agency that is responsible for the implementation and enforcement of your bill, now law. So it is important to maintain that dialogue and communication to ensure that the agency and those public administrators also implement and enforce your law in the way that you intended. And this is also where we can maybe find areas of improvement and more ideas for solutions in addressing whatever issue you are hoping to solve. So that's a very quick synopsis, you know, of the process. Of course, Florida's legislative session is only 60 days long. We do have committee weeks beforehand, but everything happened within that 60-day timeframe. So it does move pretty fast, which is why I mentioned connecting with lawmakers, especially this summer, is a very smart strategy to consider, because we're back in Tallahassee for committee week starting in September, with Florida's 2024 legislative session scheduled to begin in January. So it's an earlier year this time because of the election cycle. Whenever we have an election cycle, our session meets early in the year. So with that said, I'll step back. I'll see what questions folks have. But thanks so much again for your engagement, your advocacy, and your interest. I look forward to hearing what you have on your minds.
Thank you so much. You're getting a lot of applause in the room.
Thank you.
So I have a couple of questions first before we open it up to the floor and our Zoom participants. Thank you so much for talking about coalition building. We were talking about that earlier in the program, and we were speaking with Representative Harris here, one of your colleagues. So we asked her to talk about some of the effective advocacy strategies that what is she keen to the most? Are there any things that you look for in advocacy that you'd like to share with us?
Yeah, it's a great question. So my first reaction is that it's always better to call people in before you call them out, right? These are very polarizing political times. And we can be inclined as humans to make assumptions about people based upon their political partisan identity, maybe based upon their gender, based upon, you know, their age. Like we have a habit of making assumptions about people before we even get to know them, right? And I would really encourage folks to try to, as much as you can, pause that processing and have a conversation with that individual first, because I think sometimes you'll be surprised of what agreement there can be, whether it's with coalition partners or even lawmakers on different issues and concepts. So sometimes it's that lawmaker just doesn't know better. They're not an expert in that topic. They never heard about this issue before. So for example, maybe you've never seen your representative ever talk about these issues. You might be inclined to think it's because they don't care. Now, I mean, candidly, that might be why, right? Like, I don't know, but it's good to find out, because sometimes it's not that they don't care. They just have never experienced it before. And I'll tell you, one of the struggles I have with the legislature I serve in is most of my colleagues, they don't necessarily express empathy unless they've experienced that trauma or that challenge themselves. So we have a job as allies is to build empathy, is to help lawmakers, even if they've never gone through this specific scenario, to help them understand why this policy matters, how this is a reality for their constituents, and why they should get involved. But we shouldn't initially assume they just don't care. Sometimes it's that they just don't know about it because they've never experienced it before. And so I do think it's important, you know, to, for example, before session even starts, like invite a lawmaker to tour your organization. You know, if you're involved with a local nonprofit that maybe helps with employment opportunities for individuals who are blind or visually impaired. Like I have, you know, Lighthouse in my district, and I've toured and have talked to their employees and I've met with the staff there. That gives me a really important perspective that I maybe didn't have before, right? Because I've never had a chance to get to know this nonprofit, to visit their facilities, to see the good work they do. So I think even before you get to legislative session, you have to think of creative ways to build those relationships. And part of that is inviting that lawmaker and their staff to meet with you or to come to, you know, your place of work, or maybe you're part of an association like this one, or maybe a community center. Like you try to give them exposure to what your challenges are, what your experiences are. And then you talk about policy. So that has always been very effective with me. And that includes organizations where, again, the assumption might be that we don't agree. Like maybe we don't agree on every issue, but we can find common ground on at least one topic. And so to not assume, you know, worst intentions, but to kind of lead with an open heart, I think is a really smart advocacy tool that sometimes we underutilized because we make assumptions about people before we get to talk to them. Now, with that said, if you talk to someone and they continue to be belligerent or, you know, disagreeing or whatever, then you can shift your advocacy to, you know, more direct, right? But I always am a firm believer in trying to practice soft power before you practice the hard power in communicating to your elected official. And a part of that too is because I have seen many of my colleagues become defensive if you come at them heavy and hot, if you will, right? So, I mean, that's a natural human reaction. Like if someone tells you you're doing a bad job, you know, your first reaction is to probably be defensive versus process that feedback. So politicians, I have found, can be even, you know, ironically more sensitive than others, though you should have a thick skin in this work. I have found many of my colleagues to be even more sensitive than you would expect. So I think to just be thoughtful in building a relationship, and then, you know, if that is not going to be effective, if you tried and not get anywhere, then to shift your advocacy to be more aggressive. But I wouldn't start out aggressive. I would build up to that point. And that can help keep a door open and build relationships in ways that you maybe never thought you could in the past.
Thank you so much. I love how you keep emphasizing the building the relationship. That is something that, that our committee here is really wants to happen within the Florida Council of the Blind. I have a two-part question for you. It's no secret that you know, a lot of eyes are on our state at this moment. Can you talk a little bit about effective ways that we as individuals and we as a grassroots organization can make our feelings known to you and your colleagues personally and also to the body? And the second part of that is also how we come to you and we ask for help. How can we help you in the issues that you are fighting for and against?
Yeah, great questions, Anthony. I mean, on the first front, of just the, you know, how do you communicate in the most effective manner? So there are many ways to communicate with elected officials, right? You can come to the office, meet with the staff, meet with the lawmakers, set up a meeting to meet with lawmakers. You can, of course, call our offices. You can email our offices. And then you have social media aspects. You can follow us online. You can tweet at us. You can send us a direct message. You can comment on our social media accounts. So there are so many ways, but the question is, like, what's most effective, right? I do think that in-person conversations are the most effective. And when we're in Tallahassee, it can be a pretty intense meeting calendar. Like, there will be days where I've had upwards of 15-minute meetings, because that's typically how long you have with lawmakers when you're in the state capitol. So again, I do encourage you to set up meetings prior to Tallahassee, because you'll probably get just more FaceTime and it'll be a little less chaotic. And then when you come up to Tallahassee, it'll be an easier meeting because introductions have already been made. So you're kind of more following up versus having that be your first ever encounter with a lawmaker. The other aspect to consider is testifying in committee. So if you ever want to talk to multiple lawmakers at once, I would say you have two options. One is your county legislative delegation meetings. So every county, before we go back to session, will host a local delegation meeting. This is a meeting where all lawmakers who represent that county come together to hear updates from the public. And a lot of times, you know, the meetings will start with the government updates. So for example, the county official, any local universities, some of the bigger nonprofits, they'll be the first ones to speak. But then the floor opens up and people, organizations have upwards of 3 minutes to share their perspective, their thoughts, their priorities, and to get the attention of the entire delegation at once. We have not announced the Orange County delegation meeting yet, but it will likely be in the fall. And just a good opportunity to talk to all 15 lawmakers of Orange County at once. So I definitely recommend looking out for those details. We'll share them on social media once they're available, but that's one of the best ways to talk to everyone in one swoop. But the other opportunity, as I mentioned, is during committee. Now, a lot of people assume that you can come up to, you know, maybe you have an issue focused on healthcare policy. Folks assume that if the healthcare committee is meeting, they can just come up to the podium and talk. The unfortunate part about Florida's legislature is you really can't do that unless you're speaking on a bill before the legislature. So, for example, we had a situation recently where somebody who was housing insecure from the Orlando area, not in my district, but she was, you know, from the Orlando area, she came all the way up to Tallahassee because she thought if she did that, she could have some sort of platform to talk to all the lawmakers. But the reality is that unless there's a bill that you're speaking on, lawmakers will not let you speak in committee. And that's an intentional decision with the House rules, where it creates an environment where you can't just come to the microphone and express an opinion, even if the subject is somewhat related. You can only speak during public testimony on a bill, and you have to stay on the topic of the bill. So in that situation, you know, we met with her one-on-one and we helped her and so forth. But just a reminder that you can only speak in committee if you're speaking on a bill. And with that said, there's plenty of relevant bills that you might want to speak on. So it's good to know what bills are on the agenda and if you oppose or support them, or if you just want to provide information, that's another opportunity to speak to the legislature in more of a group setting. But I would say those are your two main opportunities, and, you know, finding other ones could maybe take shape of local town halls. You know, for example, we're in the process of planning a town hall with myself, Representative Harris, Representative LaVon Bracey, and Representative Lopez all at once. So we're hosting that, you know, as Orange County lawmakers, but that's not normal. Like we're doing that on our own regard. We haven't been required to do that. So it can be harder to find those opportunities. It just depends on how engaged that lawmaker is with their community locally.
All right. And the second half of that, how can we help you?
How can you help us? So, I mean, honestly, a few things. One is that you are the experts, right? So we look to you to keep us informed on issues that matter. So if there's a bill that I have coming to my committee that you don't like, to let me know that is very helpful. Because, you know, as informed as we are and as hard as we work, we're not going to see every issue from an expert lens, because we're just not experts in every topic, right? Like, I know I try to be informed, but at the end of the day, you're going to have a lot more perspective and knowledge and insight on issues that impact your life more than I will. So to be proactive in notifying lawmakers, hey, House Bill 266 coming to your committee, here's why I don't like it. Or, hey, this bill's coming to your committee, here's why I do like it. If you have questions, let me know, right? So I think that is super, super helpful. And the same goes to just letting us know what your priorities are. You know, this is what we're going to be looking at this session. This is where I'd like for your attention to be at. All of that is very, very helpful. The last point I'll say is just be an engaged voter. We want everyone to vote. We want everyone to be registered to vote and to help hold politicians accountable, to tell your friends and family to vote. You know, turnout in Florida has not been strong. And so we want to make sure that we're also encouraging just like civic engagement as a whole, because I do believe firmly that a healthy society has a strong engagement from their electorate. And so encouraging your peers to be registered to vote, to request and update your vote by mail ballots, like all of that's also very important. It gives me confidence in the future of our state when we have stronger voter engagement levels.
So we're going to open it up for questions. We'll go to Zoom first. And as we do, I just want to say, as you approach the end of your, you know, your term limit, your cycle in this part of your career, first and foremost, thank you. But I don't think this will be the last that we hear. So do we have any hands yet in the Zoom room?
There is one hand raised, but I'm going to need some assistance because Zoom threw me out and I lost my co-hosting privileges. So,
Oh no.
All right, just unmute and say hello.
Well, this is a person that needs to be allowed to talk.
Oh, okay. So then we'll take a couple of questions in the room and come back to Zoom.
Okay.
I guess I'm talking to the screen up there. Shannon Shelton, you said about bills. Y'all attach bills on top of bills. And why is that? I did the math. There's a possible 294 bills y'all could be passing. But why is it that y'all put a bill and then on a bill on top of a bill? Is that a quid pro quo type thing? I mean, isn't that kind of illegal? Shouldn't a bill be by itself?
Yeah, great question. So There are house rules that should limit some of that activity, but the loophole that many of my colleagues exploit is the title of a bill. So I always watch to see when a title of a bill is amended to become more broad. So for example, you might have something that is, you know, policy that is focused on, let's say, you know, gun issues. So the bill is titled an act related to guns. So if that's the title of the bill, then any amendments for that bill have to be related to guns. You can't pass an amendment that is about, you know, some other topic. It has to be explicit to guns. That is what House rules requires. However, if the title changes to public safety, as an example, then you can amend that bill to have anything about public safety. So now you can start talking about issues with law enforcement, or maybe even incarceration, or maybe even mental health funding, right? Like, so watching how a title can be expanded can absolutely allow for what you're describing to take place. Another example is anything with development. So I'm always looking at some of these kind of construction bills, like bills that are focused on construction issues, because it's pretty common for the title to be amended to become growth management. And the second it expands to growth management, like that opens up the door for, you know, anything about sprawl, development, environmental degradation. So you kind of have to watch those changes, because chances are what's happening is that there's a lobbyist or some sort of special interest that is watching that bill to be a vehicle for something else, as you mentioned. So a lot of cases that is designed to sneak in bad legislation that the public doesn't like. And the thought process is, if I do that through this amendatory process, the public might not notice. And or if it's done on the House floor, there is no public testimony. So, for example, this happened several years ago with the rights restoration legislation. So I don't know if folks remember Amendment 4 back in 2018. You know, Floridians voted to allow for there to be the rights restoration of returning citizens. And then the legislature passed a bill to require all fines and fees to be paid before that can happen. And they did that as an amendment on the House floor. And the reason why they were able to do it was because the title of this bill was about elections. So it was so expansive that they were able to attach that language to the bill. Same thing with the attacks on Walt Disney World. This most recent legislative session, two separate bills were updated to have these Walt Disney targeting. And one of them was a bill on transportation, and the other one was a growth management bill. So they basically threw language in those policies about Disney, even though like the public didn't testify on them. There was no vetting of that language. So I would say oftentimes it is designed to avoid public scrutiny. It's designed to get something into a bill that avoids public testimony. It also makes it harder for the media to get word out about it. So it's not a good practice, but it is allowed within House rules pending the title change. And as Democrats, we all voted no on the House rules, but they're, you know, not enough of us to actually stop their passage or implementation.
Thank you. We are coming up close to the end of our session, so we could do one more question in the room, one more question in Zoom, and then we have some prizes to give away.
Okay, one sec. Hold on.
Were we able to allow our Zoom participant to speak?
No, I have not been able to do that. I have called out for help, so I'm so sorry to that person.
If it happens in the next 5 minutes, just break in and let us know. All right, okay. We'll do one more question in the room.
It's DJ again. My question is, okay, so the bill is going through its process. and has been passed, or perhaps it's not been passed or been on delay, either stopped at the governor's desk, awaiting veto, or whatever it is. How would the person who is advocating for this bill know that the bill has been passed or rejected? And how can they do follow up on such matter?
Thank you. Great. Yeah, great question. Awesome question. So when legislative session comes to an end, there are over 100 bills waiting for the governor to consider passage by signing into law or rejection through veto. However, it's not every bill automatically goes to the governor. So the legislature actually decides when to transmit bills to the governor, and they have 60 days to do so following legislative session. And there also are timelines in the state constitution. So for example, when a bill is transmitted to the governor has 14 days to decide what to do. And if they decide to sign it into law, then it has an implementation date. Some bills are implemented on July 1st. Other bills are implemented upon signature. So every bill will be different, just depending on what the language says. And then a governor can veto it. There's also a third option. If the governor doesn't sign it, it automatically goes into law anyways. So the governor doesn't have to always veto something or sign something. If they have something transmitted, they never sign it, it goes into law automatically. So those are typically your three options. And there not only are there specific timelines of when things must happen based on our state constitution, but there are notifications. So if you go to myfloridahouse.gov and flsenate.gov, which is the Senate version of the House website, you can actually track legislation. It's totally free. When you go on that website, there'll be a little button on, I think it's the upper right corner, that says tracking. And you can actually track your bills, and you could do it by keywords. You can use the bill number, and you'll get email notifications when anything happens with the bill. So if it gets agenda to a committee, if it gets amended, when it's transmitted to the governor, you will get notifications. And I think that can really help keep you up to date without having to constantly check, you know, the website all the time. As a lawmaker, I also get email updates. So I get emails from the governor's office and from the legislative offices on when a bill is transmitted, what gets signed, what gets vetoed. So if you're working with a lawmaker on a bill that you've sponsored, they should also help keep you in connection. Our team does that as much as we can. But using the tracking service on the websites can help you keep on touch of it without having to lean on someone else.
Thank you so much. Thank you for sharing your time with us today and for giving us this basis of education. So in conclusion for today's program and panel and conversation, often when we understand more how the process works, we feel more invested. And I hope that that is a byproduct of what happens today. But more importantly, building our local relationships, which is what the second half of the year's focus for the Governmental Affairs Committee is key. And I hope you learned that today. One more point I wanted to expand on that we're not going to have opportunity to speak about today. Often by the time bills are bills, it's almost too late to have any effective advocacy done. And so if we as an organization make a commitment to establishing these relationships on the local level, but also in our national offices too, then we have a much more effective way of reaching out, and we can pull so many more of our representatives together if we have these relationships established. So thank you all so much for coming. Representatives Harris, Escamani, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us. I appreciate y'all. See you soon. Thank you.